Good morning. Pursuant to House Rule 10.01, I'm calling this remote meeting of the House Preventing Homelessness Division to order. The committee legislative assistant will take the role to determine which members are present.
Chair Gomez.
Present.
Keeler.
Present.
New Brindley.
Present.
Davids. Heinrich.
Present.
Hollins. Hornstein.
Present.
Howard.
Present.
Cagle. Petersburg.
Present.
And Ryer.
Present.
And that is a quorum.
Thank you, Mr. Clerk. Can I have a motion to approve the minutes for January 20th, 2021?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Representative Hornstein moves approval of the minutes for January 20th, 2021. Is there any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, if you guys could unmute for a second, all those in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes for January 20th, 2021 are approved. So we're really lucky to be joined today by the Department of Corrections. They're going to talk to us about the relationship between incarceration and housing insecurity. We heard some about this last week when we heard directly from Minnesotans impacted by homelessness, but we're looking forward to hearing from the Deputy Commissioner, Curtis Shanklin, who has joined us today. Mr. Shanklin, if you could please introduce yourself along with the presenters for the record and proceed with your presentation.
Absolutely. Thank you, Chair Gomez and members of the committee. Curtis Shanklin, Deputy Commissioner here at the Department of Corrections, where I oversee our Reintegration and Restorative Services Unit. I will be joined by two of my esteemed colleagues, Director of our Reentry Unit, Kelly Heifert, who will also be followed by Kate Erickson, who is the Department of Corrections Community Stability and Supports Program Director. And then I'll just go ahead and proceed, Chair, if that's okay. So again, Chair, members of the committee, let me first just offer and say that I continue to hope and wish that all of you and your families are continuing to do well. And stand blessed and healthy as we all continue to deal with the uncertainty of a global pandemic that I think has impacted a number of our lives in many different ways. And let me also just say we're grateful to be here today before the committee, and I sincerely thank you all for the opportunity to take part in this conversation. I'll give a quick brief overview of the Department of Corrections, as we typically don't have the opportunity to appear before committees dealing with issues that impact homelessness. After that, my colleagues will cover information regarding the DOC's work regarding release plan processes for incarcerated women and men when they are released back into the community. And then we'll spend some time digging into information regarding housing instability and incarceration. The DOC has completed a strategic plan which has articulated our mission and vision in light of the realities that are facing our incarcerated women and men. Our mission here at the department is transforming lives for a safer Minnesota, and we are undertaking a realignment of the work to better position ourselves.
Well, what I'll do is I will just have her send in a new one. So can you just...
I'm sorry, Rep. Davids. Thank you. Sorry about that.
Oh, you're good. You're good. Thanks, Chair. As I stated, our mission is transforming lives for a safer Minnesota, and we're currently undertaking realignment to better position ourselves to meet that mission. Our vision is achieving justice through the promotion of race equity, restoration for harm, and community connectedness. This vision, in part, I think, is illustrated by our presence here today, as I am of the belief this committee recognizes the interconnectedness of things like poverty, housing stability, violence, and victimization, along with just an involvement that exists in our communities. That also, I think, speaks to the work that happens in the Reintegration and Restorative Services Unit, which is the unit I oversee, comprised of a number of units, reentry, which you'll hear from some of, again, my esteemed staff who will speak to that, hearings and release, our Juvenile Justice Reform Unit, Field Services, Risk Assessment in the Community Notification, and Grants and Subsidies. And while many of you are probably aware of the state of our 10 state correctional facilities at the Department of Corrections that we oversee, we also at the department provide community supervision to over 20 individuals statewide in a number of our 17 district supervision offices around the state. It should just be noted that Minnesota does rely heavily on community supervision. And while Minnesota has the fourth lowest incarceration rate in the nation, we also have the fifth highest supervision rate in the nation too as well. I think currently we're at one of our lowest rates for our incarcerated women and men in our state facilities, roughly around 7,200. But we also have north of 100,000 adults and youth who are on probation statewide. And just wanted to make a note of that because part of that is we think about our incarcerated women and men transitioning into the community. The work that goes on in reentry, and you'll hear more about this, is really the core of how we provide supportive services. And when I think about our work to provide services, I'm reminded of a quote by Shirley Chisholm, who was the first African-American elected to the U.S. Congress. And she stated that service is the rent we pay for the privilege to live on this earth. And I think that quote embodies, I think, the onus on all of us as public service, as we look to continue to provide supportive services that impact those who are in our facilities and are transitioning back into the community. So again, I'm going to wrap up because I want to make sure that my colleagues who are going to speak in depth to what you all care about have an opportunity to get through their presentation. But again, thank you, Chair Gomez and members of the committee for giving us the opportunity to speak here today. And with that, I'll pass it on to my colleague, Director Kelly Heifer.
Good morning. And thank you again, Chair Gomez and the committee, for the opportunity really to join you today and talk about this work. Deputy Commissioner Shanklin had talked about our mission statement in DOC of transforming lives for a safer Minnesota. And our reentry services unit strives to really make that mission possible by partnering across not only our DOC divisions, so our facilities divisions and operations, but reaching out to other government agencies like partnerships with MHFA and with DHS and community supervision agencies across the state. So not only our DOC supervision, but CCA partners and probation services as well, and then the organizations that are within their communities. So our unit's purpose within that mission really is that justice-involved individuals have access to all of the services, supports, and the resources they need then to be successful in their communities. So we reach across the state really to use what works in order to help change lives. So the diagram that you see on the PowerPoint are the different functions within our reentry services unit. You'll hear specifically about one today, but here's a brief overview about those other service and support areas. So we provide leadership at the correctional facility level for services that support evidence-informed case planning. We work into release planning, restorative justice opportunities to help people restore themselves, and then transitional and pre-release services. So we're reaching between facilities and communities to make meaningful and necessary connections with people, providing opportunities for men and women to be released early under our work release authority, to go to work, participate in education or vocational training if they're appropriate to do that, working with community service providers, again, in those agencies, and impacted people to creatively address those barriers that are created when people have criminal histories, the barriers that are presented by that. So things like employment connections, meaningful work and careers, access to treatment services for substance use disorders, mental health challenges. We had met earlier this week with Representative Hornstein around identification documents and the importance of that, creating bridges to healthcare through medical assistance and insurance and needed benefits. So making connections for incarcerated people or criminal justice involved people, for folks that can be supportive in helping them to transform their lives. So in talking about this work, I use that evidence-based or evidence-informed practice. Sometimes we use a lot of fancy and complicated words really in our venue to describe things like reducing criminogenic needs and decreasing recidivism, targeting risk factors. And an important word that we throw around is something called responsivity. And really what that means, it describes the context for change when we're working with impacted people. So what makes change possible for them in a way that's meaningful for them? Adequate housing and addressing homelessness are credible and urgent responsivity factors. There are really two primary reasons for that. And the first, in corrections, we have a public safety need to provide supervision for folks, supervision and support. And how do we do those things if folks are homeless and we can't really locate them? It's a very difficult and daunting job. But secondly, and I think is even more critical, if people don't have a roof over their head and a place to call their home, even if it's a temporary space for a while, how can they manage all of those things that they need to do in order to change and to sustain that life, to transform? So how do they get a job, take care of their mental health, break the cycle of addiction and more if they're facing homelessness? A question you might be asking yourself right now as we're talking about Department of Corrections and releasing people in homelessness is, why would Department of Corrections even release people who are homeless? So I can tell you a little bit about the why or the how when that happens. It certainly isn't something, you know, that we set out to do, and we aim to mitigate it. So facility staff throughout the Department of Corrections work with the supervision staff who will eventually have those cases and the impacted person to try to locate suitable and available release addresses. So where is it that that person can go? Do they have an existing space or with a support person? Do they need program assistance? We have some really good connections and great partnerships with organizations and some individual landlords, right, throughout the state. It certainly is our goal that everyone has a safe place to go, and there just isn't enough spaces and places and connections for every single person throughout our state and locations to go. So DOC has statutory limitations that we can't, nor should we, keep people in prison longer than their obligation to us. And sometimes they get released homeless. So realizing this is an important and critical factor, 2 years ago, our unit in community services realized the importance and that critical nature of homelessness and the impact it has on criminal justice involved people. So to support people in transition and adequately supervise them, we reorganized our community reentry direction that included a focus on mitigating homelessness. So we worked to form our community stability and supports team. Kate Erickson serves as that program director for this team in reentry services. Kate leads a small and very mighty team of people that reach across the state, attempting to remove barriers for impacted people in our communities, increasing access to supports and services, and they have a large focus on mitigating homelessness in many different ways. So they're helping us all to better be responsive to people's needs in that transformation process on the ground and in communities in Minnesota. So Kate will share some more information with you about homelessness and criminal justice involved clients. Kate?
Good morning. I am so excited to be here. My name is Kate Erickson. I'm the Community Stability Program Director with the Minnesota Department of Corrections. And I just want to share this, that I know that not only is this committee historic for our state and the focus of the committee, I also know that this conversation that we are bringing in and the information that we are bringing to this group is historic as well. And I want to let the committee know that I am fully, fully present in that moment. So I am very excited to share this information with you. So as Kelly stated, I lead the team, this tiny but mighty team of the Community Stability and Supports team. Just a little bit of who comprises that team. So within that team, we host the position of what's known as the Child Support Liaison, which is a shared position between the Department of Human Services and the Department of Corrections. And the Child Support Liaison not only is primarily focused on mitigating circumstances related to child support, but also really overarchingly operates under the umbrella to focus on supporting kids and families and really economic stability for correction systems involved persons. In addition, we help to support and guide the work of our facility transition centers. We provide technical assistance for resource development, specifically resources that have housing as a level of service. And so that technical assistance is happening with our community partners, which kind of lends into and goes into how we are able to engage. We're a very external facing team within the Department of Corrections. So we engage with our state agency partners all the time, specifically our friends at Minnesota Housing and Finance and the Department of Human Services. We connect with our other friends and colleagues at the Minnesota Interagency Council on the Homelessness and the Olmsted Subcabinet. So we have the ability to interface with local governments and governments of all levels, tribal nations, community providers, and most importantly, we have the ability, which is my favorite part, which is engaging systems impacted persons and families so that we ourselves can learn how to be better at supporting people in living and thriving within the communities. But last and not certainly not least, but most importantly, which encompasses a lot of my time, is actually mitigating circumstances of homelessness for individuals that are on correctional supervision or preparing to leave. And that gives a lot of information, which not only we're learning about individual community systems and some of those systemic barriers and policy barriers that exist to perpetuate those experiences, but also we're able to take what we learn and influence up to the planning level and policy level. So before we go into this information, what I really wanted to say is I know, a friend of mine at the Department of Health will tell me that data is about truth telling. And I know that I'm going to show you a lot of pictures and images and show you a lot of numbers. And I want to just share, and I want to state this and name this, that I know that there are people behind these numbers. We have all heard their stories. We also know that experiences of homelessness are a compilation of a lot of persons' traumas, of their experiences within and engaging within different systems, and a lot of events that have unfolded within their lives. Homelessness itself has homelessness and housing instability is a very, very complex issue, and we know that it's going to take everyone. We know that this complexity in this issue is going to take all systems operating as one system in one Minnesota. And so our intent in sharing this information today is really to insert ourselves into this space, into the solution-seeking space, and to illuminate the possibility of how if we intentionally connect with interventions to prevent and end homelessness for persons who are correction systems engaged, what might we do in order to support the ending and preventing of homelessness throughout for all Minnesotans? So within this first graphic, what I want to highlight here is really the universe. So this first graphic, and when I say the universe, this is all individuals who are in correctional supervision within the state of Minnesota. And as you can see, when I say correctional supervision, I say probation and supervised release. This data is recent. I ran this data on January 19th, so just a little over a week ago. So what I want to highlight to you is not only first and foremost, there were 4,000 people that were identifying as being homeless or lacking housing stability who are on correctional supervision. That's a lot. So the other piece that I want to highlight and draw specific attention to is the blue shaded area. And in the blue shaded area, what that shows is the number of individuals who are on probation, let me repeat that, who are lacking housing stability and are homeless. And so the question that comes, if we are again operating as one system, when we deconstruct our systemic silos and operate as one system in this solution-seeking space, what might happen if we were to intentionally connect and support people and prevent and end homelessness for those persons and families that are impacted by correction systems involvement who are engaged with probation, how might we potentially impact or prevent an experience of a commitment to a Minnesota correctional facility? The next slide here is really, it's the same individuals that are represented in the prior slide. So this is 4,000 people that were on probation and supervised release. However, this is disaggregated by race and gender. So what I want to draw specific attention to, and just want to name, it really probably would have been very helpful to compare these numbers to other race demographic information from the state of Minnesota overarchingly. However, I think that we can reasonably have a presumption to know that there's going to be disproportionate representation of certain populations who are experiencing homelessness. And I'll use the example that we know that the population of Minnesota, of the women that live in Minnesota, we know that that population is not comprised of 16% of women who identify as Native American. However, 16% of the individuals who are on probation and supervised release as of January 19th, of the women who are on correctional supervision in those two spaces are Native American. What I want us to challenge ourselves again with is how might this information challenge us to direct resources to certain population groups in order to really not only, I mean, we know that these inequities exist and we need to begin combating the inequities. So now we're moving further into this journey. So in human-centered design, the humans are at the center and we are exploring the problem space. So this is further into this journey, which this is talking about the data that's in front of you, the image that's in front of you, are people experiencing homelessness and non-homelessness releases following a release from a Minnesota correctional facility. So again, this is the universe of individuals. So this is, it illuminates people's experiences, where they have gone afterwards, but I wanna specifically draw your attention again to 2020. So in year 2020, pay attention to the orange and yellow, or excuse me, the orange and purple that's at the top. So the orange and purple sections are homeless with shelter, people who experience a homelessness following release, and homeless without shelter. So that's approximately 3,000 people who have been released from Minnesota correctional facilities in this year of a pandemic, in a space of homelessness. I just want to say that 3,000 people, we have a lot of work to do. What this information provides us, the silver lining of this information, is what it provides us is a baseline. And this baseline for year 2020 is something that we are already working on. We want to shrink that purple. We don't want anybody to be released to any sort of experience of unsheltered homelessness. So now, again, we're continuing to drill down further into this information. The graph before you represents where individuals went following release from a Minnesota correctional facility, and this is disaggregated by county. So again, unsheltered, I want to emphasize this. This is specifically unsheltered releases. So in the years 2019 and 2020, dialed it from 2017 down to 2019 and 2020. So as you can see, approximately 50% of the individuals that experienced unsheltered homelessness following release went to four counties. So just to call that out, it was Clay, Washington, Scott, and Polk counties. Now, I want to be clear, this is not an indictment of these counties, rather an illustration, and I believe that we know this, and I believe that we've heard these stories, but homelessness is not an urban issue. In addition, how can we, again, use this information along with connecting with our community partners and our state agency partners and operating as one system, how can we use this information to allocate resources and services to meet the needs of these communities? What comes to me is how can we use the correction systems? How can we see the correction system as an opportunity to connect with this intervention that we speak of, not as an experience that reinforces otherization or continues to perpetuate disparities. I apologize for the fuzziness of this graph. It just came to me this morning. Now we're again mining further in, okay? So again, this is the experience of Native American women who have been released from our Minnesota Correctional Facility in Shakopee, unsheltered homelessness, an experience of unsheltered homelessness in years 2019 and 2020. What I want to draw your attention to is an attachment that you received, which really details some work in a collaborative project that the Minnesota Department of Corrections has the opportunity to connect with. And what that project is called is the Improving Criminal Justice Systems Response Grant. It's a grant that's funded through the Office for Violence Against Women. And the reason why I want to draw your attention to that, because on that handout, on that attachment, you will see the words and the stories of the women that are behind this data, the women that are behind these numbers. So what that project focused to do was, so the women who are a part of that project, they have a common denominator, of one of which is, their common denominator is that they are all survivors of abuse, violence, sexual exploitation, and sex trafficking. And when in these conversations, so it was both women who were incarcerated at Shakopee within our Minnesota Correctional Facility in Shakopee and women who are correction systems involved within the community. So one of the questions they were asked was, what do you need? What do you need in order to live and thrive and disengage with the criminal justice system when in the community? What do you need? And their responses were unparalleled. They said housing. They said they needed housing. And so what I feel we can do with that information and what this information shows is that I feel that we can be very intentional and direct our energies to help Native American women return home and do so safely. I also want to draw attention to the map. So this is the first time that we have this map there. And I want to identify just some of the communities, if you were to look at and pay attention to some of those outstate communities. I believe this information in this map challenges us to question, are we collectively supporting and assisting our tribal nations in a way where they can meet the needs of their communities? Because this is where these women went home to. And they went home unsheltered homelessness. So many times in the last few years, I've been asked to mitigate experiences of homelessness for Native American women who are on correctional supervision, and they were trying very hard to do the work of change. And they were vulnerable, and they asked for help, and they refused to trade their bodies for places to stay. And I am thankful as an agency that we were able to offer that assistance, but we as a system have a lot of work to do.
Ms. Erickson, and just I wanted to interject briefly because we have some hands, just to let members know that we're going to let Ms. Erickson complete her presentation and then go to member questions. If you could just make note of your question. Thanks.
So I just have a few slides left, and I'm excited that there are questions. So thank you for that. So in this slide, in this image, we show another experience of another population of persons who are correction systems impacted. And so with this slide, you can see the numbers, you can see what is there. But what I do want to draw attention to is the other attachment that you were provided, which details a data matching project between the Homeless Management Information System and the Department of Corrections. So just to be very direct and very specific, the Homeless Management Information Systems, for those of you who are not aware, is the data management system that is utilized by homeless and housing service providers within the community that receive state and federal funding resources in order to operate their services. So what we did was we took that public data for people who are entering into commitment and who are exiting Minnesota correctional facilities during a set period of years, and we matched it within the homeless management information system. We wanted to see what people's experiences were coming in to Minnesota correctional facilities and leaving. And what we learned really was that of the people coming into Minnesota correctional facilities, being committed to prison, and of those that had also touched the homeless management information system during that period of time and then touched that same system following release, that over 40% of those individuals were Black men. So I believe that the question here then that we need to address and solve as one system in one Minnesota is how might the cyclical connection between the systems perpetuate disparities? And what can we do together to impact the inequitable engagement within these systems? So this is the last population example, and I could really go on and on all day about this, but I know that we have an agenda, and I know my friends are coming behind us from the Office to Prevent and End Homelessness. So this is the last one that I wanted to draw attention to, which again, in data mining, we have more questions that we want to answer. This is what makes us excited. So this is not an effort to admire the problem. This is an effort to really direct our attention and really, where do we start to direct our attention and prioritize the issues that we want to solve first? And I believe that if we work together, I truly, truly believe that if we work together, we have really powerful brains and we have really lots of that we can learn from people with that have lived this life, that we can do this. So this depicts the experience of people who identify as immigrants who have been released from Minnesota correctional facilities in 2019 and 2020. Now let me, again, unsheltered homelessness, right? Sleeping outside, sleeping in places not meant for human habitation. When viewing this information, I again want to draw your attention to the map, because what I hear question is I found this map very interesting. In my prior work experience, I was a corrections agent in many different areas of the state. And many of the communities that are represented within the geographic areas have industries that rely upon an immigrant workforce within their economic makeup of their communities. And I found that to be very interesting. So how can these potential industries be a stakeholder in addressing this issue or addressing the issue of preventing homelessness and ending homelessness for persons with this experience? So now we get into the big issues, right? And again, I say these issues, but I have hope. I have lots of hope. I specifically say for persons and families. So housing instability for correction systems impacted persons and families. And I say that very intentionally because right now I'm working with an individual who's a dad, and he was released from prison probably approximately 6 months ago. He's on correctional supervision. He's doing very well. He is behind on his rent. He is very fearful of the lifting of the eviction moratorium. His employment and his income have been impacted by COVID on a number of different levels. He has mental health concerns that he grapples with, and he is in recovery. This person is also a dad. He's a single dad, and he's a single parent of a daughter who is on the autism spectrum, and he himself is also homeschooling her, in addition to working on changing his life. He lives in a smaller community. He knows that there's not a lot of options. Rental vacancy rates are low everywhere, but he knows that he doesn't have many options if he is evicted from this from his home. And he is stressed. He is so stressed he can't focus. And so we have the ability to come in with our own financial resources. But his story really touches on all three of these pieces. He's afraid of this eviction moratorium being lifted. He received his notice for eviction, even though he knows that he cannot be evicted right now. He's still afraid because if he tarnishes his relationship with his landlord, how does that make him vulnerable for continuing to live in this residence beyond that time? In addition, the lack of affordable housing within his community, and in all reality, there could potentially be community resources that could help him, but oftentimes there's a delay in receiving those resources. And so how is it in his immediate urgent circumstance right now? So we're very fortunate, and this is like the best part of my job when we are able to come in and help him to get stable, and then so he can focus on the hard change work that he is doing. But this is what we mean when we talk about an opportunity for intervention to support people in a space to look forward to housing stability. So the last piece here is the successes. And Curtis touched on some of the, oh, I'm sorry, Deputy Commissioner Shanklin touched on some of these successes. And I'm really excited about this. I'm excited pretty much about everything because I really love my job. So I'm sure that that is, that there was no mistaking that. Thrilled that the DOC's strategic plan prioritizes housing stability. Thrilled. Thrilled that that is there. I believe that creates automatically a sense of shared purpose between systems with our friends at Minnesota Housing and Finance, with our friends at Department of Human Services that have these awesome programs that are able to support people in long-term housing stability. In addition, imprinting a person-centered focus. At the heart of a person-centered focus is identifying and seeing that person for who they are as an individual, really shifting focus from what did you do to what happened and how can we help. And really, our agency's commitment to prevention and homelessness for persons who are correction systems involved. Really, we have this continued commitment. So whether it's engaging with our state agency partners or engaging with people within community or really meeting communities and all of those community partners to help support that organic development of resources, because the communities really are the subject matter experts. The correction system is not. But what can we do to come to the table and how can we support the solutions? And that's all I have.
Thank you so much for that presentation. We really appreciate all the information you shared. We have a few member questions we're going to go to. First was Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Erickson, and other presenters. This is, you know, I'm a data person, so I like seeing the numbers. I also like hearing the stories. One of the questions that came to me from that is on one of your early slides where you have the bar chart of showing the change from 2017 to 2020 in terms of numbers and percent. And we still have a huge problem. There are way too many people on this in this chart, you know, the 3,000 who are still experiencing homelessness. What I'm wondering is, were there specific projects that you did, excuse me, as a department that brought it down from the over 6,000 in 2017? In the interest of saying, what have you learned in terms of ideas that work, things that don't, best practices, and how do you take a small staff and enable others to learn from these best practices? Thank you.
So thank you, Chair Gomez, and thank you, Representative Liz Ryer. That's a great question, and I'm really glad that you asked that. So first and foremost, I hesitated. I thought I was going to click back to it, but I thought that might be distracting. So yes, in 2017 to 2020, there was a reduction. But however, in 2020, still way too many people, 3,000, way too many people. So how is it that we have impacted and really how is it that we can go forward and move forward? Like, where do we start, right? And so with that being said, there's a couple of things. We haven't had enough time. That data is actually relatively new to us, and we haven't had a lot of time to really unpack it and identify the milestones along that chart to really kind of think about where it is that has been the best practices. But there are a few that I can name that are a little bit obvious. So for instance, between 2018 and 2019, there was a significant drop. We had a new administration elected in 2019. And we had new leadership come to the DOC at that point in time. I would also say that in 2018, between 2018 and 2019, we also implemented a policy, a different release planning policy that helped us to focus more specifically on addressing the issues of homelessness and housing instability. We thought about things in a little bit of a different way. We are continuing to do that now, I will say, because with our strategic priorities and our person-centered focus, we really need to intentionally inlay a lens of equity. We need to perform an equity assessment across all of our policies and our practices. So that is something that it's not just happening within me, within my tiny team. That is something that we as a DOC and as a correction system as a whole are doing. So I'm thankful that as a whole we have this focus, because that's been one of the blessings of this work, is that we've really spread the wealth. We've really been operating as a team across agencies and across systems. And I'll say that we are visiting about this very topic within our Olmstead sub-cabinet. We were visiting about this very topic within our Minnesota Interagency Council on the Homeless. And I know that through, for instance, through different programs like Commissioner Jennifer Ho at MHFA championing the expansion of bridges. We know that there was a bump in the bridges so thank you for that support. And we're really thinking about how to target those already resources in a very intentional way. So I'll say that with that, you take a tiny staff, but then you talk about it a lot. And so here is another example. Us being in this space is how we can affect and impact change as well.
Thank you, Ms. Erickson. Representative Breyer, did you have anything else, or was that good?
That was good. The only thing is, could you send a link or information about the strategic plan and the person-centered approach? That would be great. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for the presentation. There was a lot of information in there, much of it very interesting. I have just a couple of questions. My first question is, I thought the statistic that 50% of the folks who are released experiencing homelessness are in four counties. That's an anomaly, and especially I was a little surprised by what the four counties were, Clay, Washington, Scott, and Polk. And so I'm wondering, do you know why that is? I mean, is it that that's the location of correctional facilities? Is it a lack of resources at the county level? Is it, are there higher crime rates to begin with? Like, why in the world do those four counties have such a significant problem?
Ms. Erickson.
So, Chair Gomez, Representative New Brindley, what I can say is that we haven't had the time to really unpack and analyze that. What I will say is that your reaction regarding, holy smokes, that is not what I expected, was one that we too ourselves experienced when we saw that information. And I think that your question also gives credence to the fact that we need to explore the why behind it. We need to explore in those areas and the reasons behind that, because that's the only way we're going to really get to some effective solutions. This is just the initial step into this representative data that is our initial effort to data mine into this. But I will say the success in this is that we didn't know that before. So what would happen if we took some concerted efforts and made and to really focus on those communities and to focus on our own practices too. I don't want to, I mean, we have definitely got to clean our own house before we invite anybody over for dinner. And that's what our strategic plan and our person-centered focus is going to support us in doing. But we definitely, like, what could happen if we did some really intentional work within those spaces? I think that we could have a great impact.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative New Brindley, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I appreciate that very honest answer. And I appreciate, frankly, the sort of approach of the chair with this committee, that we really are about digging in and figuring out what the problems really are. So I appreciate that. And yes, it seems really critical to know the why in order to be able to figure out how to fix it. So I appreciate that. My other question would be, you mentioned this gentleman facing eviction, and obviously that's a concern to everyone. My question is he eligible for the state rental assistance program? Do you help folks navigate that existing system? How do you interact in that way, and how does that function?
So Chair Gomez, Representative New Brindley, what I will say is absolutely yes to all of that. So one of the requirements of doing this work is essentially having knowing a little bit about a lot of information that unfolds across 11 tribal nations, 87 counties, all far reaches of the state. So in that circumstance, our first step is, what are our local resources? Because those are faster and those are quicker, and those are going to be more responsive to him right now. Also, our objective is always to connect individuals with community. We want people's relationships with the correction systems to end. You know, we want them to end. However, we know that our role is critical in kind of understanding where they are in their space of transitions and reentry, which is traumatic in and of itself. So our first steps are always locating to some of those local resources that could offer that hand up. And I say hand up very intentionally and not hand out. So those are the first steps, knowing who our community partners are, knowing those steps in engagement. I will point this out, though, and I think that this is quite obvious as well, and we all know this, that COVID and the pandemic required human and social service systems and housing and homeless service systems, required them to rewire in a way. So we are learning these right along with that individual. But he's the one that's at a more critical disadvantage. So how is it that we can take all of that information and make the best plan possible? And I will share with you that that is always done very, very mindfully.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Ms. Erickson, Representative New Brindley.
Thanks so much, Chair Gomez. I appreciate the opportunity. And I just want to say I really appreciate that answer. And I think a really critical component for our committee and the work we're doing is sort of parsing out where the greatest needs are and where resources already exist. And it sounds like, I mean, for this gentleman, and I'm sure so many people, there are resources and there are already mechanisms in place to help with that. We need to be in a place where we make sure that, you know, we've talked about this too, that intensive case management wraparound support is there to make sure that people know how to connect with the resources that already exist. So I really appreciate the presentation and what you said. And now I suppose that's part of our task, is really parsing out what's there and what's not, and where are those greatest needs. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much, Representative New Brindley. I'm really glad that the county thing really jumped out to me too. So I think that that warrants some further discussion by us. And so I look forward to digging in as more analysis happens of this data. So thank you so much for those questions. Vice Chair Keeler, you're next on the queue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, team, for coming and presenting this. If you all think your mind is blown about the data, I represent 4A, which is Clay County, and I am devastated that this is happening in my communities. We talk about homelessness so much. So I appreciate the work that you've done to share this. I have a lot of questions. I think that we maybe need to meet offline to dig into this a little bit more, but I have one clarifying question that I just need to figure out, if somebody gets released and they move to Clay County and they need a permanent address, are they able to be permanently housed in North Dakota? Or if you're released from a Minnesota correctional agency, do you have to stay in Minnesota?
Ms. Erickson.
So Representative Keeler, Chair Gomez, Representative Keeler, I was waiting actually for my Deputy Commissioner Shanklin to answer that question. So first and foremost, I'm just gonna scale it up. So if a person is released from a Minnesota correctional facility and they return to a community and they are homeless, there have been circumstances where they are able to temporarily shelter especially within that community, there are circumstances where they can temporarily shelter potentially for a night over in North Dakota, but there are interstate compact and supervision compact agreements between states. And so that question in and of itself, I don't want to leave you hanging, because I can only imagine what you are feeling right now, having seen this data. I don't want to leave you hanging, but I think that that question we can take with us, and I can have some better subject matter experts be able to address that in greater detail.
Ms. Erickson, Representative Keeler.
Thank you. You're not leaving me hanging, because we are definitely going to follow up on this, because I know from the North Dakota side, when they're released, they're able to find a permanent address in the Moorhead side. This is one of the things about being a border city that we talk a lot about, is that, border city exchange and how we house people. One of my other questions is, I appreciate the work that you've done around the Native American women, and I read through that report extensively. One of the things down at the bottom, when we asked, what are some things that you're missing and what are some things that you wish you had, it was around education. We've all said in this committee and other committees how education plays a really important role in leveling up in your life. We know the disparities happen as early as third grade. We know the prison, third grade to prison pipeline is there. My question is, what kind of education credits, opportunity, life skills are you providing while individuals are in your care, so that when they leave, they have the skill set to go out and get some of those jobs that maybe they didn't have the opportunity to prior?
Ms. Erickson.
Chair Gomez, Representative Keeler. So what I will say this, again, I'm going to scale that up, because the question that you ask is in the face of a changing landscape. So in our strategic plan, we endeavor to do just that. So we are endeavoring to connect individuals more with educational opportunities, where living wage and living independently and thriving within communities is not only an aspiration, but it's an outcome. So with that being said, with that attachment, what I also wanted to say with that attachment that was there with what the women had stated, so they identified housing first and employment second, that they needed suitable employment. And so I believe that those go hand in hand. And so what I didn't necessarily dig into as it relates to that specific work is, first of all, I want to point out that cultural specificity in resource development is a significant need. We all know that there is significant disparities, whether it's homelessness and housing instability within the justice system or within the correction system. And so one of the words of those women were that we needed a culturally specific resource in order to help us return to completely disengage and to live successfully within our communities. So with that being said, in that specific group, the women are coming together to not only design a housing resource in the coming months, that's going to be the ultimate output of that project, is they are going to create the words, they are going to create the conceptual framework that designs this housing resource. But those women are also going to design how they receive services and what types of services that they receive therein. So I think you bring up an excellent correlation, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, which is housing stability goes hand in hand with economic stability. And this is a conversation that is happening across systems within the state. There's a housing stability work group with the governor's office right now that is really talking about that. You can't talk about housing stability and ending homelessness without talking about economic stability in other areas. So I definitely, definitely, definitely love your questions, and I welcome your suggestions as it relates to incorporating more of those educational opportunities. There are educational opportunities within our Minnesota correctional facilities. The fact of the matter is that many of the women are there for a very short period of time. And the changing landscape of the correction systems means that less women are going to be coming to prison, men and women, less women are going to be coming to prison. Our populations are reducing. More people are staying in community. So how do we identify and connect and support those organic development of resources that can help individuals like really take off and make that plan for themselves? We want to be informed as to how to assist people in planning their lives. That's really what we are endeavoring to do.
Thank you, Ms. Erickson. We have another presentation to get to, and this is a really great conversation, so I feel bad for like cutting it short in any way, but it seems like we need to have some more conversations, either kind of like offline or maybe again in a committee with the Department of Corrections. Vice Chair Keeler, is it okay if I just move on to Representative Cagle and then we can kind of revisit?
Yeah, that's fine. Thank you. I do look forward to having more conversations around this.
Absolutely. Thank you. Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess one of my questions is, when does that work start? Is it before they're released from incarceration, or is this something that happens after release? And then also just wanted to say to Deputy Commissioner Shanklin, go Bulldogs. Sorry about that.
Ms. Erickson? I'm sorry, Commissioner Shanklin?
Thanks, Chair. Representative Cagle, thank you for that. I figured since I was talking to one of my alum partners that I should jump in and take this. So yes, absolutely, go Dawgs. But to answer your question, yes, this process starts well before our incarcerated women and men are released, because I'm being somewhat presumptuous, but I assume you're talking about the planning that goes on to provide to make sure that they do have adequate housing or the right stability when it comes to housing, whether that's accommodations to assist them with housing support as they transition back into the community. So that takes place before they are released back into the community, and based on potentially what type of potential community supervision they will be going out on, then determines where that process typically starts. But it typically starts anywhere from 3 to 4 months out, where there's coordination between both our incarcerated women and men, their case manager, the agent, who they will then be going out onto community supervision, and two, where then they are putting together their release plan. And part of their release plan is where they are going for appropriate housing and having an appropriate place to go. One of the things that I think we aspire to do, and both Kate and Kelly mentioned that, is how do we get to a point where we're giving our incarcerated women and men a place to live and not just a place to go? And I think that also gets to some of the questions that Vice Chair Keeler was speaking to as well. And so we look forward to those ongoing conversations, along with ways in which we can really highlight our partnership with both the DHS and MHFA too as well. But great question. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. So I just really want to thank you, Commissioner Shanklin, Ms. Heifert, Ms. Erickson, and Ms. Kahn for bringing this presentation together, and for the good conversation. And we're going to follow up with you all. So thank you so much for being here. We're going to move on now to the second part of our agenda. We're welcoming back the Minnesota Interagency Council on Homelessness to share with our committee some of the lessons that they've learned during the pandemic. We heard kind of that, everything has shifted, and so we're interested in digging in a little bit more. If we could just hold questions till the end, I welcome Commissioner Tenbrook and her team. If you could introduce yourself and your team for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hello, Chair Gomez. Hello, everyone again. It's wonderful to be back. It was a great first conversation a couple of weeks ago, and thank you so much for having us back. Chair Gomez, just really quickly, could you give us a sense of how long you'd like us to take? I want to just be mindful of the committee's time.
Yes, could I ask Mr. Herring, who's the boss of the committee, to let us know what we're looking at for time?
I do believe we have two public testifiers, so we'd like to have a little bit of time at the end if possible. So if we could try and get things wrapped up at least by 11:55, I think that would give us time here. So 25 minutes is what our schedule has here.
Great, we can do it. Thank you so much. Well, wonderful. So just as a quick reminder, if we go to the next slide, you are hearing from myself, once again, the Executive Director of our Interagency Council on Homelessness, Eric Grumdahl, our Deputy, and Elizabeth Dressel. You met with us all at the first committee meeting. And next slide, please. And just as a quick reminder, too, just to refresh, we are the staff that support the state's cabinet-level interagency council on homelessness that's led by our lieutenant governor and chaired by our housing commissioner and our human services commissioner. And I'm really sorry I missed the presentation by the Department of Corrections. It sounds like it led to a lot of really interesting conversation, which I did hear most of. But I think what I took away from that is just another great example of how important this interagency response and work together is, that it really involves all of these agencies in our collective work on homelessness. Okay, next slide, please. And so what we're going to talk to you about today, you saw this slide at your first meeting, but we wanted to use this slide to kick off into a series of what we at the Interagency Council really have learned together with our partners across the state during this year of handling COVID. And I think that one of the things, while we couldn't last year because of COVID, we couldn't spend the time we expected to spend with our community partners across the state on making our next statewide plan. We think that what we just did with all of our statewide partners across the state together really kind of sets the stage for the next iteration of our strategic work together and really honing in on these key learnings and taking them to the next level in our work together. So just as a quick reminder, our summary of our responses during COVID, you know, we have a broad interagency team that includes our Department of Public Health and Department of Public Safety and many others. Our Department of Public Health team really helped provide guidance and technical assistance to all of our homeless providers during COVID on responses to really protect people during this pandemic. We, of course, had funding, a very significant amount of funding early on in the pandemic in particular, that helped us establish about 2,800 safe spaces across the state to move some of the most vulnerable folks experiencing homelessness because of their age or underlying health conditions out of congregate spaces and into safer places where they could be protected from COVID. Food support and public personal protective equipment support. We created isolation spaces for anybody who was COVID positive and did not have a safe place where they could isolate in their own home. And we're able with our partners to create enough space for really anybody who needed that kind of isolation space, which we feel very, very proud of our partners in doing. And then just this very intensive one-on-one engagement, weekly webinars with providers and newsletters, just to keep everybody informed and connected as well as we possibly could. Partnering with local governments, while we have one of the things you'll hear us talk about a little bit is we have much more work to do in understanding our lines of accountability across our system, who's responsible for what in this homeless response. I will say that we had some really tremendous partnership with local government in creating these spaces, including brand new ongoing emergency shelter spaces that didn't exist before. And then finally, just really innovative, creative uses of some of our state resources in ways that really helped not only get people into safe locations, but actually use those resources to move people from those hotels into housing, which of course is our ultimate goal, and to support them in permanent housing. Next slide, please. And so I will just talk about our first key learning, and then I'll turn it over to my team to walk through the others. You know, homelessness is a public health crisis. It always has been. But in our communities and our state, and frankly in this nation, we really haven't treated it like a public health crisis. But I think this pandemic made it so clear, not just to all of us who do this work, but frankly to the broad community of why it was indeed an important public health crisis to respond to. Before the pandemic, you know, the Department of Health was responding to outbreaks of HIV and hepatitis. Both diseases are heavily associated with homelessness and housing instability. People experiencing homelessness are more at risk for diseases of all kinds and health disparities, often because of the very nature of the settings in where they live. So the congregate spaces where it's very difficult to be physically distant. There's also intersections of trauma and substance abuse and mental health that also increase risk. And these aren't really individual level risk factors as much as systemic issues that have created the kinds of circumstances for people where they are ultimately having worse health outcomes. Before the pandemic, I can very honestly say there was very little connection between our local public health systems and our homeless systems across the state. Probably somewhat more in the metro, particularly Hennepin, but in most parts of the state, we actually had to introduce people to each other at the beginning of this pandemic so they could work together in a public health response. So we really want to keep those partnerships going. They have been tremendous and something that we will work to keep nurturing as we get past the pandemic. We actually now have a new role of a senior level staff person at the Department of Health that is now our senior advisor on health, homelessness, and housing, and will help. Part of their charge will be to do that work of building that system together, even when we get past the pandemic. And we really want to look to our public health partners for ongoing recommendations for how we operate our shelters and congregate settings to really increase the safety of those settings, the ongoing need for any kinds of testing for any diseases, COVID or others, and to really facilitate trainings on important public health issues. And then the last thing I just wanted to say on this one is that we have seen the last bullet there, we've seen the incredible benefit of our healthcare teams, healthcare for the homeless where it exists, but just healthcare teams in general really reaching out to the broader community. But one thing I really want to point to, that obviously that's been critically important during COVID, but when they go into shelters or working with people in encampments, what they're hearing from people themselves is that often COVID wasn't even the thing they were most worried about. They were worried about where were they going to get their medications for heart disease? Where were they going to get access to their mental health providers? You know, where were they going to, some of those things that are just so critically core to their well-being are also being missed. And I think we want to use everything we've just built and learned to address those post-COVID as well. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Eric to walk through the next one.
Thank you, Kathy. Thank you, Chair Gomez and members of the committee. My name again is Eric Rumdahl. I'm the Deputy Director of the Minnesota Interagency Council on Homelessness. And so for this next slide, what I really want to amplify is some of the information that we shared when we were with you a couple of weeks ago really highlighted the significant racial and ethnic disparities we see in who experiences homelessness, even compared to Minnesotans, kind of the disparities we see in Minnesotans in poverty. And so just to refresh some of those numbers to have them top of mind, American Indian Minnesotans are 4 times more likely than white Minnesotans to be in poverty, but 27 times more likely to be experiencing homelessness and 31 times more likely to be experiencing homelessness without even access to shelter. And so those kinds of disparities are among, at least for me, the most dramatic and stark that we've seen, which I think anchors the criticality of thinking about homelessness really as needing essentially and centrally to confront racism and racial inequity in order to be successful at closing that gap. Another way to think about that gap is that if we were to magically, with a magic wand, make the number of Minnesotans from communities of color and indigenous communities represented in the homeless population at the same level they are in the general population without increasing the number of white Minnesotans experiencing homelessness, that magic wand movement would cut our overall numbers of Minnesotans experiencing homelessness in half. And so the kind of profound impact of those disparities across all of the response, I guess, is really what motivates us and has only been clearer when we've seen the disparate health outcomes, not only for Minnesotans experiencing homelessness, but Minnesotans of color and Minnesotans from indigenous communities in the context of the pandemic. And so there are a variety of ways that the state has a role in helping to support that kind of confronting that disparity and really moving toward, effective anti-racist responses to homelessness. And those include things about how we evaluate funding decisions. So the Interagency Council on Homelessness in 2017 developed and implemented a checklist that was really to help guide how grant-making decisions would maximize the ability of the dollars that the state spends through its grant programs on homelessness to be reaching Minnesotans who are most impacted. There's a lot more that can be done in terms of broadening and diversifying and growing a homeless response system that really reflects the population that's served. And we've kind of described those in this second bullet as, generally finding ways to shift power to communities of color and indigenous communities in whatever ways are possible. And some of that involves devolving the ability or the access to funding in ways that are sometimes difficult for big bureaucratic systems or grant-making institutions to find ways to do that. So we've really challenged ourselves to look at that. And then the third bullet here, to really be accountable and clear in the way that we are monitoring and looking at those disparities and our progress in addressing them over time. And so I think, as you've seen already, those disparities have been a critical part of how we've even understood and described the challenge that we face in Minnesota. And so really what we want to do is also be able to spotlight the practices and the approaches that we feel like are showing some promise. There is also some really remarkable local work happening in this space that I wanted to lift up, in particular through a national initiative called Supporting Partnerships for Anti-Racist Communities that a number of Minnesota communities have joined, that is really dissecting every step of somebody's journey from being at risk of homelessness into homelessness and then back into housing, to identify the places where our systems can be not only more effective, but serve Minnesotans from communities of color and indigenous communities more successfully. The next lesson that Kathy alluded to earlier is really around the fact that because the homeless response system, to the extent that it's a system, really emerged in a fairly kind of organic way, as a lot of policy issues initially kind of are confronted when individual actors or different levels of government say, here's a specific role or opportunity we have to do something meaningful. It was not built kind of stepping back and saying, what would be the system that we would need in order to actually effectively have all of the different actors and players and levels of government kind of working seamlessly as one large system. And so as a result, there is a lot of there's a lot of players involved in responding to homelessness, which is great and an asset. It is not always clear, and there's not kind of some fundamental agreement or overall authority that says, here's who does what and how each member or each partner of that system is accountable. It's a little bit like we have built this system in more of a stone soup fashion, where everybody's tried to bring everything that they could and advocates have created programs that have responded to needs that weren't being met. We haven't been able to really create a system, though, that functions seamlessly. And the result of that is that while at times we've been able to be really creative and nimble and all those partners being largely oriented toward the same ultimate outcomes of addressing the needs in front of us and really preventing homelessness wherever possible, we've been able to do some pretty remarkable and innovative things in that space. But what it has also at times resulted in is a lot of confusion and finger pointing and uncertainty about where really the responsibility for various parts of that response should or do lie. The other piece that I'll just mention there is that it's important to understand that the homelessness system doesn't operate in isolation. It is connected to and interacts with, as we saw with the Department of Corrections presentation, all kinds of other systems, most of which have some clearer structure or organization to them. And so so I think the contrast, in particular in the context of the pandemic response, between the way that the homeless system functions and the way that other systems function has been quite perceptible. In that context, I'll just say that one of the things that has been absolutely brought home is the fact that even with all of the challenges that system confronts, there has been just some absolutely remarkable things that have happened. Kathy spoke earlier about nonprofits and local governments working with state and other resources to be able to stand up state and federal resources and local resources and philanthropic resources to stand up so many additional units of shelter so that existing congregate shelters could get decompressed, that we could actually stand up spaces for people that didn't previously have any safe space to be. The fact that the complexities of doing all of that in the midst of a pandemic that was affecting every other dimension of life. I mean, I think we have seen from this system nothing short of heroic and persistent dedication to that focus on people in the midst of a housing crisis. What we also know is that that's not a bottomless well, that the nonprofits and the local governments and the other partners that have been lifting these incredible boulders to be able to do such incredible work can't lift every boulder that exists. And so we have to find a way to also be able to build that capacity so that and to resource it in a way that is going to help it kind of operate on a sustained basis. So on the one hand, we feel like the pandemic has given us a number of important proof points. And I think we might have touched on it briefly in our first testimony a couple of weeks ago. But just as a specific example, the fact that in the days following the civil unrest after George Floyd's murder, the fact that partners from all different sectors in Minneapolis and St. Paul, in the places where encampments were most immediately endangered by the unrest, were able to very rapidly, in the space of hours, find solutions for nearly 200 people, most of which ultimately resulted in people not just being in a hotel room for a few nights, but really transitioning into stable housing. You know, that I think for us is maybe the proof point of what is possible with the right resources and support. And so we really hope to sustain that same level of urgency that our partners have demonstrated so clearly in the context of our COVID work. And so with that, I'm going to hand this off to my colleague, Elizabeth.
Thanks, Eric and Chair and committee members. Again, I'm Elizabeth Dressel, and I work with the State's Interagency Council on Homelessness. And as Eric was just talking about this idea of the urgency and ability to resource the system, this last learning that we're taking with us is just really around the need to have a stable and sustained funding source, resource the systems to build that infrastructure that's needed to solve this challenge that we all face. And so when we think about infrastructure, we're talking both about the need for increased capacity at the shelter and outreach team level, so staffing and supports around that, is also the infrastructure of housing, making sure we have enough housing opportunities that meet the needs of the people we're trying to house. And as Kathy, I think, said a few weeks ago, it's not that people are not ready to be housed, but is the housing ready to serve their needs? And so infrastructure building around the continuum of housing that's going to work for folks. And thinking about if we really recognize that this work all takes skilled staff to build these trusting relationships and making sure staff have the capacity to be spending their time focused on housing outcomes, how do we resource the system so that it can be set up to operate that way with a flexible funding source like we've been able to use over through the pandemic? Is the funding has been very flexible to respond rapidly to changing needs, and how do we continue to build a system that has that in it? So some things we're thinking about is really trying to document and think through how these investments have worked and why they, you know, paint the picture for needing to continue this into the future, really modeling the true cost of responding to homelessness, and much like we talked about before, the cost of not responding as well. And so as Kathy was saying, you know, we are hopeful to start continuing moving in this work around our next iteration of our Heading Home Together plan, and how we take all of these learnings, and this one included, to really think about what it really means to truly support and sustain the infrastructure needed to prevent and end homelessness, and really respond to this as the public health crisis it has and still is. So that's kind of what we'll be taking into all of the work around our next iteration of our plan. And next slide. And just wanting to share with you, just as it just was announced yesterday, and know that you all likely may see this, and all of this will be going before their respective committees, but just that the governor announced his COVID-19 recovery budget yesterday and proposed quite a few significant increases in funding to support efforts around homelessness. And so the first one is a $10 million increase to the emergency services program. That's been funding that has been supporting a lot of this work so far in the pandemic response, really supporting emergency shelters, drop-in centers, outreach programs, a $10 million increase for community living infrastructure grant program, where counties and tribes are integrating their housing and human services work together to talk across those and make connections. Some of these have modeled that they'll be able to increase, with this increased funding, serve more people. $1 million to establish base funding for the homeless management information system. So over $6 million for supporting and expanding veterans homelessness. So around about housing vouchers and wraparound services for veterans who are not eligible for federal resources. $1 million to increase Homework Starts with Home, which is an evidence-based initiative around assisting mobile families and school-aged children in getting stable housing. And they'll be able to serve, I think, 175 or 85 more families with that amount. And then an increase of $4 million to the Family Homelessness Prevention and Assistance Program, which provides short-term rental assistance, security deposit, utility assistance, and such to families who are either currently experiencing homelessness or are at the precipice of potentially entering homelessness. And then an increase to the Bridges, which is the state's rental assistance program for folks who have serious and persistent mental illness, as well as $100 million in housing infrastructure bonds to really, on the other side of the infrastructure, about building more housing opportunities for folks in need. And with that, I'm going to turn this back over to Kathy. Thanks.
Great. Well, Chair Gomez, I think that is what we wanted to share with everybody. And so if there are questions or conversation that the committee would like to have, we're available.
We do have a couple questions. I need to keep us on track, though. We have a couple of members of the community who'd like to testify. So if we could hear briefly from, first we have Representative Howard, and then Rep. New Brindley is on deck. So Representative Howard?
I can pass, thank you.
Okay, thank you, Representative Howard. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Chair Gomez. I will skip one of my questions and try to be brief. Mr. Grumjahl, you mentioned, and I appreciate this because this is part of the problem I see, that the system is a bit disjointed and it's definitely not working seamlessly together. What's being done currently to try to remedy that and have this work better and serve people better?
Chair Gomez and Representative New Brindley, I would say that what we've learned from the pandemic response is the ability for those partners to come together and to identify what each of us can do and to field responses that are often not possible for any one level of government or jurisdiction to achieve, but have been possible when we've come together. So far, that has been kind of, there's not a cookie cutter approach to that. There hasn't been a template that's been the same across jurisdictions. And so I think at the moment, that has largely been through relationship and negotiation and identifying where those opportunities are by connecting across those levels of government and really seeking places that we could together do more than we could do individually. And while I think that's been effective, we've really had some, as you saw, some pretty remarkable outcomes in the context of the pandemic response. It has not been consistent or systematic. And so it still leaves open some critical questions about fundamentally whose role is what. And so everybody still continues to operate in that spirit of let's do everything we can. And here's a piece we can do. Here's a piece you can do. Let's put those together. But that doesn't yet yield a consistent set, kind of set of responsibilities for each level of government or each jurisdiction to take on. I hope that answers the question, Representative.
Mr. Grumdahl, Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Chair Gomez. Yes, that is helpful. I mean, it is, and it just highlights something for the committee to work on, right? Like clearly that is an appropriate, that would take appropriate legislative action, perhaps, to bring some of that together and provide some framework and structure for that. So I appreciate that. My next question, and you had mentioned, and I think that we've seen this across every sector, certainly not just in the homeless community, but in the business community and in education and in so many things, the pandemic has provided some opportunity as well for things to happen. And you had mentioned that you were able to quickly house a significant number of homeless people in hotel spaces immediately following the killing of George Floyd to provide some an additional level of safety there. Obviously, there were problems with that as well. And I'm wondering, what led to the breakdown and the situation at the Sheraton where many of that happened? And how do we prevent that moving forward? How do we do this in a safe way?
Mr. Grumdahl or Ms. Tenbrook? I know that's not exactly a simple question, so I need to get back into that.
But. No, I appreciate the opportunity. I can start, and I'll let Eric jump in as well. And the reason I appreciate that question, Representative, thank you for asking it, is that there was a great deal of confusion at that moment about what the role we were playing after George Floyd's murder in the hotel operations and support, and what some really organic community partners' role was in that effort. And I think what you're referring to at the Sheraton was it was a situation that actually the state had no role in. The work that we did, and I'll come back to the Sheraton, I promise, but the work that we did at that moment was bring all of our partners together to work to evacuate people from some of the encampments where they were in really harm's way because of the protests, and actually work to get them with a provider that we had established working with quickly, and using our state's housing support program and other emergency assistance into hotels that were not the Sheraton. These were actually outside of that core part of the city. And then using those housing support dollars, we were able to use that to help get people on a path to housing. And so it was a very multi-jurisdictional state, county, city, you know, local community partners using resources. The Sheraton was a very different situation in that some really concerned community members worked directly with the Sheraton at first, I think, to figure out a way to have people come inside there. And that quickly devolved. And I think without pointing any fingers, I think just the bottom line of that is that it shows how important having really highly trained, skilled, professional support of people at a crisis moment like that is really, really important. And so the reason I'm glad you asked is that I think there's been confusion that those efforts were somehow our efforts around the hotels, and we didn't have anything to do with that. And the energy from the community to try to solve that problem, I think, was tremendous. And then I think what we would like to add to that conversation is taking that community energy and adding the real skilled, trained provider network to be able to actually serve people. So I don't know if Eric has anything more to answer there.
We're really getting to the end of our time. I'm so sorry. I really appreciate this line of questioning, and we're going to have you guys in front of us again. And this issue that Representative New Brindley lifted up and Eric did about the coordination and alignment is really going to be one of our core pieces of work over the next 2 years. So thank you so much. Thanks a lot for that presentation. Finally, we have two people who have signed up for to testify. We're going to start with Mr. Daniel Ford. We may have to wait until next week to hear from Sue Watlov Phillips, if that's okay, because we have 3 minutes. So Mr. Ford, welcome to the committee. If you could please just state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Okay. Daniel Lamar Ford, 63 years old. I'd like to thank you, Madam Chair Gomez, and members of the committee. My life experience in considering my traumatic brain injuries has affected me gravely. My memory is so affected, it's hard to remember people's names, phone numbers, addresses, and the ability to have relationships. Most of my social skills were learned in prison. It's kind of hard for me to communicate with people who have not been in prison. I've learned to fit in where I can, but it's still hard. I have three TBIs. In 1971, I was about 12 years old. My twin brother and I were playing at Central High School, where they were putting in sewage lines. we dug the tunnel and the ground gave way. My brother David was able to wiggle his way out. My whole body was under about 9 feet of dirt. I was underground for about 15 minutes and I was unable to move, not even a finger. And I stopped breathing. My brother ran to get my mother and said he had killed his brother. He said, I killed my brother, I killed my brother. My mom said he ran down the street to the bootlegger's house and got my Uncle Rudy and some winos come take me out. I woke up in an ambulance in a thick fog. My second TBI was in 1981 when I got hit in the head with an axe. My third TBI was in 1992 when I got shot in the head and in my lower back and in my head by the Minneapolis Police Department. This caused me to not be able to talk or move in my body for about 3 days. That was a traumatic experience. Collectively, I have spent over half my life in prison, 32 years. My TBI has played a big part in why I was incarcerated. Incarceration has affected my ability to get work and housing and caused my social relationships to suffer. Traumatic brain injuries caused me to be more involved with the criminal justice system than I would have been if I had not have had them, those experiences. Drugs and alcohol helped relieve me of some of the symptoms I suffered due to the TBIs. When I was younger, I was very social, but because of my TBIs and incarceration, I am more of an introvert and reclusive. I believe my three TBIs have been a major cause of my incarcerations, and now my prison record prevents me from getting stable housing, employment, and has affected my social skills. I want the committee to help other people with similar stories as mine, give people opportunities to involve in the mainstream. The housing market and job market, the only work outside of prison I've had was at the day labor. Being homeless and being incarcerated as I have, it causes an individual to become real disheartened and disenfranchised. It's difficult to get housing and to get jobs. I want lawmakers to give people like myself and others the opportunity to prove themselves. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony, Mr. Ford. We really appreciate your presence here today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. So we have two, we're going to end the committee. We have two pieces of written testimony that the committee administrator is going to send around. One from Sue Watlove Phillips, which is on the issue in front of our committee today.
Yeah.
The other is Mary Shoon, who is sharing concerns about her son at MSOP Moose Lake. Right. This isn't exactly in the jurisdiction of our committee, but we want to make sure that staff's working with her to connect to the proper kind of resources for her. So we're going to send that around also because she submitted it. So we're going to end our committee. Mr. Ford, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts.
No, thank you.
Your testimony really kind of underlined the things that we all heard today. So thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And with that, we're adjourned.